Way down in Missouri, when I heard this lullaby, while the stars were blinking and the moon was shining high.
Welcome to the show in Missouri, the history of Missouri, one county at a time. This week we're in Livingston County, formed on January 6, 1837 by Governor Dunklin. 539 square miles of flat plains, some of the most prettiest place in the state. We are joined here by Sherry Parks, the county clerk. Thank you for the hospitality.
Well, thank you for joining us in our county.
I sure appreciate it. We are Charlie Kerr, the Farm Bureau President here in Livingston County. Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
State Senator Rusty Black, fresh off one of the best floor speeches I think I might have ever heard last week about your dad.
I think you're being a little bit too gracious, but we sure are glad that you made it up here in the great northwest part of the state.
Now, is that how you say it? I was always trained by your predecessor to say the great northwest.
Well, he still reminds me of the right way to do it, but I don't want to copy it exactly. And we discuss it almost every Thursday on the way home from the Capitol.
I rip it off of him. Sherry Jones, the Vice President of the Livingston County Farm Bureau, thank you for the time.
Thank you. Glad to have you all in Livingston County.
And a judge that's very familiar with this courtroom. Now the Western District Court of Appeals, Judge Tom Chapman, the Livingston County guy. Thank you for having us here.
Thanks for coming.
Named after Robert Livingston. I'll tell you, this old boy lived a life. He was U.S. Secretary of State to Andrew Jackson, but he was district attorney in New York. He was mayor of New York. He had some scandals, had to pay back a clerk that stole a bunch of money, moved to New Orleans. And when he moved to New Orleans, he wrote the Napoleonic Code for Louisiana that still stands today. So one of the more accomplished and kind of unique. I've heard about Livingston counties, but I never knew why. That old guy lived a life. The Indians around here. Now, back home, we have a lot of Indian mounds because mostly they're rice levees now. But at one time, they always come off an old Indian mound. What were the Indians around here? I mean, I saw it looked like everything. Just a big mash of everybody that's ever, because the plains, I guess, were flat enough that people could migrate around.
The short bit of history that I know about that, Scott, that would definitely be true. But I want to say the town of Chillicothe was named after a tribe of Indians as well.
But I read it was named after a town in Ohio, the biggest town in Ohio of Indians before they were pushed out, was named Chillicothe. And right. It was like it was Indian for a big town.
That's right. That's right.
And covered it over here.
That is true. And years ago, I had a livestock team that competed against the Chillicothe, Ohio livestock team.
How does that work? How do you have a livestock team? We never had that back in Indianville.
Well, it was part of the FFA, and it was really at Nottoway Holt before I moved to Chillicothe. But the Chillicothe, Ohio ag teacher, they were there, and our kids run around together, et cetera. But that's when I looked on the map. I want to say there's maybe only five Chillicothes in the United States, but
what
I don't remember
compete,
that exactly.
Though? Like, what is the competition like when you have a livestock competition? What all do they compete in?
Well, primarily you're looking at three or four classes of livestock within three species. So primarily beef cattle, swine, and lambs. And then on each one of those species, you take reasons why you selected them or judged them in the order you did. And then you have to repeat those oral reasons to somebody and try to get that judge to believe that you know as much or more than they did, especially if you screw up the placing. It takes extra work.
That's interesting. We, you know, there are a lot of roll cops where I'm from. I've never heard of that. I've heard of it, but never heard that actually worked. I read where in 1721 they put Fort Orleans about 6 miles from the mouth of the Grand River. Judge, where we're sitting now, where would the mouth be? I guess it would be where the two forks come together, right?
I assume so.
Is that southwest of here?
The mouth of what river?
The Grand River.
The Grand River? The mouth would be down on the Missouri River, and it would actually be Sheridan County, Livingston County line. So New Orleans, it sounds like, was on the Livingston County side of that.
They were all one county. Before 1921, I don't know what was going on. Sheridan and Carroll County.
And Carroll County, I didn't realize that.
We separated out later.
I read a great story about Daniel Boone. He apparently came here. There was some of the greatest fur trapping anywhere in the state was here. And Daniel Boone came here and he built him kind of a makeshift cabin. And then he got one of the, in his diary he wrote, he received a message that the Indian said when they're going to kill the white guy, you're messing with him. And so he figured out pretty quick, this is not good. So he didn't check his traps for 20 days. He would only have a fire at night. He didn't leave the cabin for 20 straight days. He would keep his fire at night and cook enough for all day. Then when finally the river thawed, he got in his canoe and got out of here and went back to safety. But he spent 20 days very nervously looking out the little hole in the cabin to see if the Indians were coming to get him. I was interested. I saw the first settler in the valley was a guy named Martin Palmer. In 1817, he set up a settlement, a cabin, I'm sure, 5 miles east of Brunswick. We're here in Chillicothe. Where's Brunswick from Chillicothe? I guess it's back west a little bit.
It's east. Not in Livingston County.
It's not.
But it was in the valley.
It's in Carroll County, isn't it? It's in Sheridan.
No. Sheridan. It is in Sheridan County, okay. And along the river. The other thing that people may remember, that is one of the choke points at Brunswick on the Missouri River. So when we discuss those flooding problems in mm-hmm. our state, Holt County, Missouri,
yep.
And then you go down to Brunswick, and I believe that levee system's called the L-246. It's part of the core system. That's the next choke point, and we're working on that now in the state. And then, of course, in Jefferson City is the third mm-hmm. major choke point on that river. So Brunswick and the Brunswick-Chillicothe Railroad, folks, wasn't that right? That was the connection
yep.
between the two towns for years, and that railroad bed, et cetera, is still there with part of the trestles on it.
Explain to folks that don't know what a choke point is in the river.
Okay, a choke point on a river is where primarily in between what we think of up here, two bluffs get close enough together, or obstacles on both sides of the river, that it backs up water and slows down the water moving down the river at flood times. And it gets, during major flooding, such as 93, and then I think, was it 16 or 17 on the Missouri River, when it tore up all of Atchison and Holt County, those choke points caused tremendous amount of damage. And today we're working on the state and federal government on setting back levees to try to open up some of these choke points, because some of it's man-made, mm-hmm. and the fact the levees were close enough to the river that there's just not enough room to move the water.
A buddy of mine is a very quotable man named Steve Tilley, and we live down near the Mississippi River, and one of the choke points of the Mississippi is at Cairo. Cairo used to be one of the biggest towns in the Midwest, very successful. It is not that today. And on the other side of the river is called Bird's Point Levee. It's a bunch of the best farmland in the world, and the Corps was going to blow that levee. And they asked Steve Tilley about it, because he'd be in from Perry County and be close enough. And he goes, I'm against it. There's no way to do that. And they go, why? Have you ever been to Cairo? And the thought was it could use a bath, which it probably could. But they blew the levee on the Missouri side and flooded it. So Daniel Boone came through. Then Martin Palmer was illiterate his whole life. But he was elected state senator here and was one of the most noted early state senators there was. Never learned to read, but was one of the most respected people in the entire chamber. You know, Senator, I'm not sure you guys might do a little better if you.
I know it would for sure help if we quit reading the messages show up on our phone while we're trying to give speeches on the floor.
Yeah, if you could ban Facebook or be a leader to Facebook, I think y'all get along better. I found a story about this guy named John Tripling. I was not aware, but I guess this is one of the best places for honey in the world. The bees just were thick. This was great trapping, and it was great honey. And this guy named John Tripling developed a reputation quickly as the best honey gatherer, which at the time was a great delicacy and very valuable. And the story was he would sell different pots of honey. He would color the pots differently, put the honey in. And he would sell one type of pot to people that lived around the Grand River Valley. And then he would sell another pot, a colored pot, to folks that were traveling through and going on. Well, he stayed out one night a little late and came in a little hungover the next day. And he sold one of the other pots to one of the folks that lived here in town. And when they got to the bottom, they found a little pile of rocks in it. And he'd been waiting his honey pots to people traveling through, and he was smart enough to sell them to locals. And they lashed him 4 times, and he was outlawed from selling honey. And he ended up moving on down the river, I think, pretty quick. The first full-time settler I read was Samuel Todd. He put a cabin in a beautiful elm grove about a mile and a half west of Utica. And he also planted the first corn in the county and raised it. Sherry, how did your family come to live here in Livingston County?
Well, I don't know a lot about my mom's side of the family, but it's my dad's side of the family that lived in Livingston County. I'm probably the fourth generation. I do want to say that my dad has spent 50 or 60 years researching our family history, and I do know that we came into the United States before the Revolutionary War, and I have random connections to former presidents, and two that most people don't even remember was a president, Benjamin Harrison and William Henry Harrison, and Benjamin Harrison signed the Declaration of Independence. So, and then my dad is like Richard Nixon's ninth cousin. Yeah, he's been a lot of time.
I was not gonna guess. I could have guessed a long time before I pulled that one.
So, you know, my dad's family, they were not wealthy. They were just hard workers and sharecroppers. We did have a business college in Chillicothe. People came from all over the United States to attend this business college, and my grandma did attend and graduate from that. So, you know, probably the first person in.
Where was that here in town?
Oh, just four or five blocks from the downtown area.
Judge, how'd your family come to live here in Livingston County?
Well, I've got to look at this. I'm the sixth generation, and my great-great-great-grandparents, Gustavus and Mrs. Nolan, moved here in 1855, and then their daughter and son-in-law, John and Jemima Chapman, moved here in about 1856 or 7. And then the John and Jemima brought their son Lewis Chapman, who was the third generation in Livingston County, and he was my great grandfather who started our law firm, and I was the fourth generation in that same law firm. Wow. So that's kind of my background. And my I have some grandparents on my grandmother's side. They were German. The Nothnagels had came, I think, in the later 19th century, and then my mom's family moved here after World War II. And started a business here. Shelby and Golden Nichols started a business, a gift store here.
Gift store?
So we have kind of, goes all over the place. Sherry and I were talking. I did a little research. I did it a while ago, and I figured out that we have some relatives up the tree somewhere.
Well, family of lawyers ought to be good salesmen, right? That kind of makes sense, you know.
Yeah, I hope so.
Sherry, how'd your family come to live here?
I'm afraid I'm not near that versed and not prepared for to give you a history lesson on my family, but on my dad's side, they fifth generation at least going back in Livingston County as far as farming. I don't know where I was a reader. Was my maiden name, and readers were. Had large families in the Livingston and the Davies County area, and all pretty much involved in farming, and I don't really know a history past that.
Where's your farm at from here? We're in the court. We're doing this in the courthouse.
In Livingston County, I grew up north and west of Chillicothe, up toward Lock Springs, really close to Jamesport and the Davies County line, and now I, 40 years later, have ended up south of Chillicothe, south and west in the Dawn area.
And what do you all raise?
We have livestock, we have row crops, corn, beans, wheat, and a cattle operation. Mm-hmm. So, and my husband's family was originally from of Welsh descent, and again, a five-generation farming operation in Livingston County, at least as far back as I can tell you on that.
Senator, how'd your family come to live here?
Well, Scott, that's good. I don't know whether we want to broadcast this. This is not where I'm from. And we talked earlier about Southeast Missouri, Northwest Missouri, and as you well know, Northwest Missouri, it is generational. Mm-hmm. And I'm originally from west of here, about three, four counties, Holt County and Andrew counties, where my family is from. I do have family that lived and spent time in here. I have cousins. My father's sister married an Epperson, which is an old name in this part of the country. And I have two cousins that graduated from high school here. So that allowed me to be a little more welcome when I showed up in 1989.
When you have 30 kids in ag every year. I mean, you kind of your family grows pretty fast.
Yeah, that's true. There is a line. We moved here in 89, as I said, and for some people in this community, they think I'm from here, but others don't. My grandmother Bowman, she also, her father helped build part of the bridges that were used to move water from the north side of 36 Highway to the south side. So she went to school here in the 1920s for just a short period of time, won the elementary school. So that's my claim to Livingston County, and I'm thankful that they've allowed us to settle here and our kids grow up and graduate from school.
Mr. Kerr, how'd your family come live here?
Well, my grandfather was actually from Illinois, and both my grandfather, grandmother, their families were from Illinois. And around 1960, my grandfather saw that he was a farmer. He saw that he just didn't think he would ever be able to afford farmland in Illinois. It was central Illinois, you know, very rich, fertile farmland, very expensive farmland, too. And so I didn't actually learn this story until his funeral, but he started talking with a local realtor about looking for someplace different to farm, someplace that might have more affordable farm ground. And his realtor actually owned a farm up in the north part of Livingston County. And so he told my grandpa about this farm. He said, you need to come take a look at it. The funny part about that was the only exposure that my grandpa had to Missouri at that time is when he and grandma got married, they honeymooned at the Lake of the Ozarks.
Nice.
And so he told his realtor, look, I've been to Missouri before. There is nothing in Missouri that's fit to farm. And they argued back and forth for a while, and the realtor finally told him, he said, look, I don't know where exactly you went in Missouri, but please at least go look at it before you just write this off completely. So they did come look at it and bought that farm in 1960, 1961, and so that's where I'm the third generation on that farm today.
Them hills around the lake would turn you off to farming, I think, in Missouri. There's not much farming until you get down the Boot Hill, really, in that southern part, but that's a good story. I like that. There's a couple other small stories that I thought was very kind of telling about the area. 1835, the legislature declared the Grand to be navigable all the way to the Iowa line. Now, I have seen the Grand in different places north of those forks. You couldn't navigate anything north of where they come together, right? I mean, there's no way. But I guess today you could put a casino on that thing, right?
Yeah,
I
mean, that would be true.
And to prove this, in 1842, the Bedford, a steamship, managed to come all the way up to the forks, and it's 12 miles southeast of Chillicothe itself. It got rammed by a low water log, ruined the whole thing, and no boats would come up for the next 20 years. They were talking about how the Bedford was a new boat and got jammed up. Then the courthouse we're at right now, in 1837, they put out $50 for an 18 by 18 square building. And when the first time the county court met there was no windows and it was too hot. So the county court, they made sure and put in for free labor. They cut windows out of the logs so they could ventilate the courtroom. And then they said they had, the judge had it on Mondays and Fridays, and the county court had it on Wednesdays, and it was a community center the other 2 days for people to have community meetings in. Then the second courthouse, this was funny. We don't have any commissioners here, but this kind of reminds me of commissioners. They let out $4,000 in 1839, and nobody would take the bid to build it for $4,000. So they had to add another $1,600 to it for $5,600. They built the courthouse. Moses Burton was the contractor in 1841. And this is interesting. This surprised me because Chillicothe is a big town in the state of Missouri, especially at the time. It got condemned by the judge in 1864. Judge Chapman is amazing how many courthouses were built because the circuit judge condemned the place.
They had better quarters.
Yeah.
Understandable.
It was more courthouses have been built because circuit judges declared them condemned than any other thing. When I've read these histories, almost every other county has a courthouse that is not condemned by the voters or the commissioners. They're trying to, but the judge says it's condemned. We can't have it anymore. So they condemned they condemned this. They condemned it in 1864. And then this became an elm grove. It was called Elm Park. There was just elm trees here. And apparently the town loved it. Everyone loved the park. And they kept rejecting bond measures to build a new courthouse. And in part, nobody wanted to see the park go away. So finally, what I read, the handbill, it said it's not guaranteed to go on the park spot. So finally, from 1864 to 1912, I guess the county also just shoved in office buildings.
Well, there was an office building at the corner of Webster and Cherry over here. Mm-hmm. And they had most of the county offices there, because I did a little looking into this too. Yeah. And they had the county offices there, but they really didn't have a courtroom. So if they had to hold court, like with jurors and that sort of thing, they'd rent out spaces like in churches and that sort of thing. Hmm. They just didn't really have a courtroom.
I guess it'd make you feel a little bit bad about lying in court if he's lying in court in church, so. You know, doubled up.
So.
So after that, in April of 1912, they passed a $100,000 bond. They built an 80 by 100-foot Bedford stone courthouse, but they built it right here. It feels like this is the right spot, though, right? I mean, it is a beautiful square. You see, you know, I was in Osceola the other day, and it's, you know, they have a nice courthouse, but it's just not much on the, they still had a video rental place in Osceola on the courthouse square. And I hadn't seen one of them 5 years anyway, probably longer. I didn't even forget they existed. Gussie was there, and I was like, son, I'm going to tell you, that is a video rental place. He goes, what? And I'm like, exactly. It makes me feel old.
Or Redbox.
Yeah, exactly. So, but this courthouse square has done very well. Why do you think, I mean, this is maintained, I think. What do you think that is?
Well, partly because we have very forward-thinking people that live here, generous people. We have a wonderful Chamber of Commerce. We have a Main Street program, which, you know, beautifies your downtown area. We have had county commissioners who take a lot of pride in this courthouse and have spent money on it to refurbish it, to maintain it, and it is the centerpiece of Chillicothe and Livingston County. In our case, our county seat falls right in the middle of the county, which is not the norm for most counties. 2/3 of our population is in Chillicothe, and people just take a lot of pride in our community.
Well, it is really nice down here. I mean, the square is beautiful. It is. You've done a great job. Before we move on, we'll take a break in a minute. Before we do, I want to thank the Missouri Farm Bureau and the Missouri Association of Electric Co-ops for letting us come and talk about the history of Missouri and counties like Livingston County, which is a quarrelsome county. It has never been hard to recruit soldiers in Livingston County. In fact, when you said your family moved over here from Illinois, I was like, oh, man, I wonder if they moved here in like the 1840s or 50s, because there was a lot of folks moved over here from Illinois in that time. They were Mormons. And apparently the folks in Chillicothe were not fans. They recruited 200 soldiers for the Mormon War in 6 days. They had a roadblock, I guess. This guy named Josiah, I'll butcher the last name of my hillbilly dialect, he had a choke point of his own where he'd stop you on the road and he'd demand the Mormons' guns and tell them to go back to Illinois. And a few of them went around him, I guess, and kept it up. And obviously Caldwell County blew up for a while with people. But the folks at Chillicothe were amongst the loudest protesters of Governor Boggs to shut that down. They were not a fan of the polygamy. And at the time, I guess polygamy was very widely done amongst the Mormons, at least the ones that lived in and around these parts. But they were very willing to not just protest to the governor. They were willing to fight. And they ultimately did. It wasn't much of a war, but they definitely won it. Yet in 1860, you could tell, Governor Nixon told me, he goes, this state was very secessionist, although the history is written that counties were not so much. He said, you could always go back and look at the 1860 election. It's a pretty good barometer of where folks were. In 1860, there were 1,469 votes cast for president in Livingston County. 20 were for Lincoln. And then there was one preacher, was the local promoter of the Republican Party. His name was J.E. Gardner. And they were very nice to him. They just said, you have 2 weeks to leave the county. They said, but before Lincoln's inaugurated, you have to be gone. And then, because folks are nice around here, he had a little trouble with the storm, and the road was flooded, so they gave him an extra week to leave. And he ended up being in Monroe County, but I do think they were pretty insistent, if you don't leave, this is going to get bad for you. And he was a preacher, but he left. And then one of the best stories I've ever heard, and if, stop me if I'm telling this wrong, there were two gentlemen, the publisher of the newspaper and a local reverend. They were speaking out on the Emancipation Proclamation. And there was several meetings throughout all of Missouri, and some in Chillicothe, and they happened to say that they thought the Emancipation was a good thing. And they put him in jail. And this is the best story. It's almost too good to be true. I'm just going to assume it is. I was reading the State Archives. This is in a book on the history of Livingston County. So there's a group of 250 women got together, mostly from Utica. But 250 women come together in Utica and Chillicothe. And it was Judge McFerrin, which, Judge Chapman, this is the greatest story. If it's not true, don't even tell me. So they come over, and these two guys are imprisoned, and they thought that was wrong. Now, all the people here, none of them really agreed with them. They put them in jail for their opinion was wrong, which is something I admire. We talk about protesters, and half of them are flaky. I admire somebody for this. So 250 women come together and meet with the judge. And on day one, the judge tells them, you can't vote. You shouldn't have a voice here. I've got this under control. I jailed them for their own safety or whatever. These women are not having it. So the rumor spread pretty quickly that there was going to be a certain denial of affection by these 250 women to their husbands. And that same the same day, it was rumored that the judge's wife was somewhat sympathetic to their protest. And so by day three, Judge McFerrin let them out with an escort to their farms with the word that they are not to be touched and harmed. And so I thought that was an amazing protest by these women. I'm very confident everything's true except the best last part, and I'm just going to assume it is true because even if the guy made that part of it up, that was good storytelling. You know, yeah.
You know, you were talking about the votes in Livingston County, and I don't know where I read this, but like the vote in 1860 was, you know, obviously very lopsided. And then in 1864, it was almost 100% Republican. It voted for the Union, it wasn't Republican, it was a Union ticket.
I read in this that they were staunchly secessionist, but it wasn't, there was more ranchers here than roll crops. I mean, this is a part of this, you're getting to a part of the area outside Little Dixie enough where you have ranchers who didn't have use for slaves. So, frankly, the further you got from roll crops, the further people cared. But bushwhackers in this area really turned the people off to the Southern cause.
That's exactly right. And what I think on both of those elections, there was a lot of intimidation going on both sides of that. Because
Union
was stationed here and was running the place, basically. It was run, but it was occupied by the Union. And so
I remember
those
the day of Fort Sumter, they pushed a cannon out on where the courthouse was still, but on the square, they put a Union cannon out there with some soldiers.
Yeah.
And Chillicothe really wasn't bothered.
So the votes weren't exactly, I mean, I think the sentiments weren't reflected in the votes as much as you might imagine because there was a lot of intimidation. Kind of, you didn't want to do that. And I don't think the ballot box was quite as sacrosanct as it is now. So people kind of knew what was going on.
Well, I know I read where when Price came through on his raid, he did not, I never read anything about Chillicothe.
We never got touched. Really, there was no, nobody was hurt.
Well,
there was no
Boonville, Glasgow,
there was one church that was burned, and other than that, we came out pretty clean throughout the war. The one thing I was going to say about my family was these Nolans that moved here, they moved from Virginia, and I think they had slaves, and they were very pro-South secessionist. Then their son, they brought their daughter and son-in-law, who were very pro-South and Southern secessionist, and then when the war started, the Nolans and their daughter had died by the time the war started, and Civil War started, the Nolans bugged out because it was becoming more of a Union area, and they didn't want to be here because they wanted to kill their slaves. So they moved out, and my great-grandfather, Lewis, was left kind of on his own when he was about 13 or 14 with his brothers, and they became hardcore Union. it's like they just totally, so it's kind of funny.
Well,
things changed.
It's so interesting throughout the state. People talk about slavery, and yeah, but it was a lot of economics. Like in Rolla, my buddy David Steelman's a bit of a historian, and he was telling me how the railroad ended in Rolla at the time. So the Union had a huge encampment in Rolla. Now, Rolla did not have, is a bunch of hills. There wasn't many row crop farms, so people didn't have an economic reason to care about slavery. And the Union being encamped there did business with everybody. I mean, everyone in Rolla did great business selling things to the government. Rolla was one of the more Republican parts of the state, because in Bolivar, too, through the railroad stopped. So it was economic as much as anything. And then the bushwhackers, I mean, if somebody comes in and steals all your stuff and burns your place, I mean, you're going to, their cause is not going to endear themselves to you.
And I think that there were not many slaves here ever. I mean, it was not a big part of the living.
What do you think it is, the breakdown of row crop to livestock? But I mean, in Sheridan County, it would be far more row crop, I would assume.
Far more.
This is where you start to have ranching come in.
Far more row crop here too.
But, you know, we do have a fair amount of livestock. Livingston County is a little bit unique. We do have the river bottom around the Grand Thompson rivers. We've got some smaller creeks throughout that you've got some bottom ground, but you don't have to get very far from that, and you get up into the hills. And you know those hills are very suited for grass and livestock.
I live right on the break, where 20 ground is flat as this table, and then 40 acres of just hills and rocks, and it's right where the delta really does begin, right there in Butler County. It is where it totally goes flat.
It's a lot more hilly up in the northwest corner.
Well, it just feels like this is where Little Dixie, there's no coincidence Little Dixie slows down here, because your row crop farming starts to slow down a little bit and you get more into ranching, you know. Well,
I just want to say the answer to that question would have been a little different, not maybe 20 or 30 years ago. Corporate farming has changed family farming. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't raised on a farm, but I have a lot of family members here that are farmers. And so they still farm and still have a lot of row crops, but a lot less livestock, a lot less hog farming.
Dairy cattle.
20 and 30 years ago, we had a lot of cattle and a lot of hogs on family farms here.
We'll take a break here. I want to thank the co-ops and Farm Bureau for letting us come here. Talk about history of Missouri here in Livingston County. We'll be right back after this.
We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we're for the Missouri way of life. We're for worrying less about the what-ifs and more about the why-nots. We're for checking off your bucket list and then making a new one. For starting a family, a business, a tradition. And if you find yourself starting over, we're here for that too. We're for building a life in Missouri and then going out and living it. And when it comes to making sure everything you've built is protected, we're for you. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance.
The Show Me Missouri podcast is brought to you by our friends at HALO, Heartland Area Landowners. HALO is a membership-based organization for folks interested in farming the sun and the wind. HALO members are passionate about their land, our world, and stewarding the resources that feed America, power, and its economy. Farming the sun and wind has incredible benefits for farmers, landowners, and all Missouri communities, all while helping secure America's energy independence. To learn more about HALO and how you can get involved, visit heartlandowners.farm. That's heartlandowners.farm.
Welcome back to Show Missouri, the history of Missouri one county at a time. We're in Livingston County, Missouri, in the great Northwest. Sherry Parks, the county clerk, thank you for having us. I appreciate the hospitality.
Thank you for being here.
Judge Chapman, Tom Chapman on the Western District Court of Appeals, thank you for making the time in a place you're very familiar with, right?
That's right. I was a judge here for 7 years before I got my current gig at the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, you spent not that long. I mean, I know a lot of folks spend a lot more time in a circuit court before they go to the appeals court. 7 years, that's pretty quick.
It was, although I practiced law for 19 years before that. So, you know, sometimes, you know, they start in early.
Yep.
Like Ryan Horseman, I think he became a circuit judge much younger than I did. So it's kind of usually I started in a little older than some.
Sherry Jones, the Vice President of Livingston County Farm Bureau, thank you for making the time.
Thank you.
And a fan of the State Fair. We have that in common. I love the State Fair. Rusty Black, State Senator for up in these parts. Senator, thank you for staying with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Scott.
And Charlie Kerr, the Farm Bureau President here in Livingston County. We were talking before about the breakdown and the changes in agriculture. Before we get to the business community, I want to talk about some famous folks here. And to me, when you start talking about famous folks in Chillicothe, I think of Jerry Litton. We got a chance to visit about him this week. Tell folks that may not be that much of a historian about Jerry Litton.
Jerry Litton was a congressman from Chillicothe at that time, and he really grew up over in Sherry's neighborhood on the Davies, Livingston County line, and very, very close to that line is really where he grew up. As a youngster in the eighth grade, an ag teacher from Chillicothe went and met with his father, Charlie, and Jerry's mother, Mildred, and talked him into coming to Chillicothe to high school. And, of course, the football team played a role in that as well. But a guy named Crabtree talked him into coming over here to school because he'd have better opportunity in the ag program to do that. So he made that choice to come here and ended up a state FFA president.
Back then, could you just do that if you wanted to come to another school? Could you just do it?
I would imagine that's probably what happened at that point in time.
Today there'd be paperwork, miss you, throw a fit. I mean,
I would imagine you're exactly right, Scott, because we drive by his farm. I drive by the farm where he grew up, and it is on the county line. And the county line is a division for our school. So my guess is nobody raised too much cane about it. And he moved over here. I know you and I talked about this the other night, that he met with Harry Truman, and Harry Truman told him to become financially independent before you go into politics. And Jerry did that through the Charlet breed of beef cattle.
Now, where was that farm at? I heard it was beautiful.
Yes, it's north of the courthouse, probably a mile and a half. Would that be pretty close? Maybe a mile.
Golf course is now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's where the public golf course is at this point.
I heard
the
golf course.
Ranch home is still there.
It's one of the first times where the golf course made a place uglier. I heard it was so pretty. People wanted to come tour it and stuff because they kept it in good shape.
Scott, I've got to get elected another time, so I'm not going to join in on that conversation. But, it was really a sight to see. And in our ag department is a model of that farm. So you can go in and look at the model of the ranch and the different bull barns and et cetera and see what it looked like through, I don't know, probably they started really tearing things down sometime in the mid-90s. It started making its change, et cetera. But anyway, he ran for Congress, served in the Congress. You and I talked about his TV show dialogue with Litton. I think worked very, very hard around the state, ended up winning a primary for U.S. Senator in our state that a lot of people didn't think that might not be possible.
So after I talked to you, I went and read the next day. I kind of had my interest piqued. And it's interesting today, you know, we have a primary for governor with Mike Keogh, a guy that is very charismatic. And then you have, in his primary, he had Jerry Litton, who was legendarily charismatic and thought of. And Stuart Symington's son ran.
Yes.
And former Governor Hearns ran.
Yes.
And
Wheeler ran too, didn't he?
Yeah, but it was surprising. While he was mayor, he didn't get but like 2%. Yeah. But Stuart Symington's son came in second. And he beat the son of the incumbent senator. And although it's interesting because it talks about how Litton was very close to Symington and was like his youth chairman when he ran for president
right.
and things. But he ran against his own son and stomped a mud hole in him. I mean, he got like Schmidt number, like 50% in that competitive race. Kind of interesting how more things change the more they say the same, you know?
Oh, yeah. Listen to the dialogue of Litton's. We're arguing about the same things today they did in the 1970s, honestly. The words changed a little bit, but the actual topics are the same. But unfortunately, the night that he won the primary, as we've discussed,
like
there was a plane crash at our local airport, which is south of Chillicothe, just a small distance, and then you have to go east along 36 Highway to find that our local airport, and with him, his wife was killed, and both children, and also the man piloting the plane, erupt from here, that a very successful businessman and his son. But I think you alluded to people probably didn't think Jerry Litton had too much of a shot of winning. Fairly new congressman, not known around the state, but you said he worked and. His chief of staff is still alive here in town, and I visit with him all the time.
Who is that?
His name's Ed Turner. He served on the curator board, and he was very active. And then a guy named Bill Jackson was very active as well. But they did a very good job at that time with only telephones and cassette recorders coming up with a political game plan. You know, I'd also say in the state of Missouri, there weren't firms that helped do those things at that point. It was individual groups went together and tried to come up with a system to try to win an election, and they did that. So that was a proud thing. And there are Livingston County people sitting in here can tell you other stories about him. But I spent a lot of time with his mother when we moved here.
Ms. Jones, did you know their family?
Very well. I can probably tell you more history about that than I could my own family. Jerry's father and my aunt by marriage were brother and sister, and my mom did not have a family as such. Her mom passed away when she was born, so she was basically very much a part of the Litton family as far as hanging out with all the siblings and very close to Jerry's mother. And growing up then, we had they were like family to us, went to a lot of events that they had. And I was actually in high school and chairman of the Youth for Litton campaign when he ran for Senate at that time. And so have a lot of fond memories of that
people
time.
People forget. I mean, 76 was the first national election after Watergate. Kit Bond lost re-election for governor. It was a very bad year for Republicans. If he would have survived, he most likely wins. I mean, he's highly favored to win that seat.
I think Jack Danforth would probably say the same thing.
Yeah.
My connection with him, with Jerry Litton and his family, was first of all, as a kid, that was like the day for, I imagine, another generation, like when yeah. Kennedy died. I mean, it was just stunning. I was 10 years old, and it was just horrible. My parents knew him very well.
And
knew
such
the
a tragic thing on the night of your big victory, because I assume the primary was probably harder to win the general if you really was mapping it out. The night of your biggest political victory, that's when you passed away. That's just...
It was horrible. And my Jerry's wife, Linda Somerville Litton, she was in my parents', one of my mom's maid of honor, bridesmaids. And so they were very tight with my parents, and it was just horrible. I mean, everybody was so upset, and it just kind of blew a hole in the town for a while as far as just spirits, I thought. It was tough.
I do know my dad talked about, he was,4-H FFA age around the time that the Litton Ranch was going big, and he talked about that, Jerry was very encouraged kids to be involved in things, and that, he said you would go to him and buy a show animal to raise during the summer, show at the fair, and you didn't pay for it till after the fair, and if you kept records and you lost money on it, that he didn't charge you for that animal. So, he was very encouraging to people.
That's awesome.
To be involved and, be successful.
Well, that's a good story right there. That's awesome. It is an amazing legacy, even a person from the Boot Hill. You've heard the legend of just how he just liked the room up, and people just wanted to be, and it kind of reminds you a little bit of Mike Kehoe. I mean, from the story, I know him personally, the stories I've heard, that was kind of the similarity I took from it. And then you hear today he's running against some old boy's son too, kind of how you said, these things repeat, you know what I mean? Now, let's talk about some folks that maybe Chillicothe's not as proud of. Ray and Faye Copeland, the oldest convicted serial killers in American history. I think it was the oldest woman sentenced to death ever, right? I'll just tell that story in case, not to bring the mood down, but so apparently the old guy was a cattle swindler, right? And he would write checks that wouldn't pass, so they wouldn't, the stockyard wouldn't sell him any cattle, so he'd get other people to go write a check to buy the cow, and then you'd never see him again. And I thought this was, when I was first reading this, I thought, well, this is like from the 1910 or 20s. But I was like, checks, would you just take? So this was in the 80s, right? And then I read where a Crime Stoppers, which I would assume is a relatively new, I guess I was born in 1980, so what's new to me would be not new to Kelton here. But Crime Stopper hotline tip of some guy that said, I know a guy that worked with him, and he tried to kill me one night, and I know my friend is missing, and I know he did it. And they thought it was so silly, they just went out and kind of looked around for a minute. And then I guess when people heard they were out there, other people called in to the local sheriff and go, no, I'm telling you, this is where you ought to look. And they go out there and find five bodies and others they didn't have the ability of the technology to authenticate. But death penalty, right, Judge?
Yes. Now, Faye's death penalty was commuted to life. And then Ray died before they could execute him.
Well, these people were in their 60s before they went on trial, right?
He was a terrible person. He was abusive to her and just an awful human.
I read it was commuted because at trial they didn't let the evidence come in that he was abusive. And then Governor Holden gave her a medical something to go to a rest home.
I think Ray may have even died in a nursing home because he was so senile that, it was easier to put him in a nursing home than to take at that point. But the best piece of evidence in that case was they kept a checklist, and the people that worked for them that did this check scams. They were kind of, the transients that worked for them were kind of involved in the check kiting scam or whatever you want to call it. But the ones that they killed, they put a check mark next to. That's how they kind of figured out who, that she was involved in it, because I don't think he could write, I think was the, is how they knew she knew what was going on.
Well,
is that right?
Roughly. I believe so. And I understand that they went to like soup kitchens to pick up these homeless people because they were transients and they would be less missed.
I mean, that's his rubble sort. Yeah.
I worked at the bank that he brought all of those folks in to open up their accounts. And I sat in an office right outside of where the new accounts desk was and watched him bring people in and open their accounts up. And my dad was a mechanic for Massey Ferguson north of Chillicothe and was known at that time for being a pretty good mechanic, very down-to-earth, redneck guy that Ray didn't trust very many people, but he trusted my dad, and he would come and pick him up at the store, drive him out to his house, have him work on the tractor, have him come in for dinner, and then bring him back to town. And during a little bit of the time that this was going on, of course, my dad never seen any of those people or anything, but
I guess it would be something so incredible that you just wouldn't ever think anybody would do something like that.
And at that time, there was no rumor of that. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it was before.
Well, it'd just be such
started.
An amazing thing.
Yep.
You just wouldn't ever think,
yep.
Right?
That's it.
They chose their victims
yeah.
wisely, I guess, is a horrible way to put it. But they picked people that nobody knew and
well, I read
followed up on.
One guy, he said, he calls his hotline, leaves his message, and says, I worked cattle with this guy. He went to this farm. He's never come back. He goes, I worked cattle there once. And I wrote a check, and he tried to kill me, and I escaped and left. And he didn't call the cops or anything. He just went on to the next ranch. He says, but my friend, Jesse, I know what happened.
That guy, I think, was the one. The story was Ray would take him out to wherever it was that he was burying him, and he had got that guy, the one that you're talking about, that turned him in. He was looking. He said, look down in that hole down there. And the guy turned down, and he looked over, and Ray was pointing a gun at him. But he looked him in the eye, and Ray didn't kill him.
Wow.
That's the story. That's how that guy survived, because apparently Ray, if you were looking him in the eye, he wouldn't do it, or he wouldn't do it with that guy.
Wow. Yeah. What an incredible story. Let's talk about something else. My goodness. you mentioned the business college. What was it called?
Chillicothe Business College.
And here, when did it? Is it?
Oh, my. It has not been in operation for a really long time.
1960.
Okay, yeah, but it was here for a long time, and we have a wonderful museum here, and there'd be a lot of information there, but people came from all over the place, and people traveling through, people, senior citizens or retired folks who travel through your community, they stop in courthouses a lot, and they'll pop in and say, you know, I was from Ohio, but I came here and went to Chillicothe Community College. Now, my grandma would be 100 years old at this point, and there's not a lot of those people left anymore, but it was really a big deal to travel to this small town.
During the war, they used it to train soldiers on some level. It was converted
oh, wow.
to use for that, and I don't know the exact story on that, but they had all the, you know, the dorms and things, and they used it in that sense.
I did a piece at Wentworth about the old military college down in Lexington, and they said they sent their people to do logistics to the business college here. They during the war, they moved all, because they needed space for more soldiers, they moved all the logistics training they did at Wentworth up to here,
probably
and they farmed it out.
Probably there.
So you mentioned Moses Dickinson.
Yes, that was one part of the history with an AME church that was here in Chillicothe, and I don't remember all of it exactly, Scott, so let's don't do too much fact-checking.
Right.
You hear me on the floor, okay?
Well, let's not fact-check that one story about the old gals getting them guys out of prison either. Let's just let that one set.
But my understanding, Rodney Mouton is a person here that moved to Chillicothe a few years ago, and he's very much a historian. This AME church, the thing that I remember from this story was the first AME church north of the Missouri River. And this Moses Dixon started in Ohio somewhere in the 1820s. He ended up in St. Louis as a minister and involved, we talked about Civil War earlier, was a character within the Civil War, but somehow ended up in Chillicothe and got this AME church started here. And the reason why that became important, our community really got behind this church. At one, the congregation was no longer using it, and I'm going to be guessing 15, 20 years ago is when that probably completely stopped. And people were discussing just tearing it down, which would be normal, move on. Well, a group of people in town got behind the idea that we need to save that church. So they did. It was bought. There were business people in town associated with getting it bought. And they moved it to our museum that has been mentioned earlier. And now it's considered our African museum here in Chillicothe. And it is really something to go watch. And Moses Dixon was part of it. And if you read his history is something of its own to look at. But I don't know how long he stayed in Chillicothe, but he was part of the beginning of that church.
Well,
and we watched them move that church right down Highway 65 through the middle of town to its new location. It was quite an ordeal to watch that go through town. Everybody left their office and they left their businesses to come outside and watch that.
I'd say so, yeah. All right, we got to talk about one more thing before we go. Sliced bread. Who wants to tell the sliced bread story?
Well, I was pointed at, there are a lot of people that need to add to this sliced bread story. Of course, this was a little earlier than me. It was 1928. But I did, because we were going to meet today, I think the person in our community that deserved credit for digging this out is somebody called, her name's Kathy Ripley. And she was an editor at the Chillicothe newspaper, and probably times you get bored once in a while and you're just going through and reading old stuff. She found this article, if I remember right, where it started at, and she just kept digging and digging on that article with the idea that, hey, Chillicothe, state of Missouri, may be the first place in the world that there was commercially sliced bread. So during the process, she found the inventor's son, this Otto Rohwedder. Did I pronounce that right, German guys? And by getting a hold of him through the guy that was the company that come up with bread ties to begin with, that's how the connection ended up. And that guy was in Minnesota. Well, she come up with enough documents from both the son as well as documents here in different type of archives that the verification went through the Smithsonian, actually. In our museum, I believe, or maybe Kathy has it, the list of where the first 100 of those machines went, bread slicing machines, and somebody sitting here may know what number the one is in our museum here locally. But the Smithsonian has loaned Chillicothe one of those bread slicers that were...
Now, what's the name of the museum it's at if folks are coming through?
It's Grand River Museum. Is what it is.
Historical Society.
Yeah, and it's Grand River Historical Society is the name of the organization that takes care of them. And it's really the church, AME Church, is there, and the bread slicing machine is there as well.
Isn't there a less complete version of the
Sliced Bread Center. Yeah, that's another thing. We don't want to forget the actual building in which that occurred, and the owner at the time was Frank Bench, right? And I go to church with one of his nieces, but the local community has bought, it's a non-profit, has bought that and done some restoration work.
They sell sliced bread?
Sell sliced bread? If you come up on July 7th or whenever the parade is that time, they'll be slicing bread in both places as well. So
and a bread tasting contest as well.
I judged that one, Sherry. As a politician. Oh,
no,
you did too, Tom.
That.
that was worse than a baby show, Scott. I immediately got talked to by the guy that runs the radio station, News, why I didn't put his bread in the top three. I will never do that again.
When I ran for office, somebody said, don't ever judge baby contests or anything like that.
Well, I had to experience the stupidity of judging one of those things before I realized to stop.
Well, I always want to thank our sponsors, the Missouri Farm Bureau, the Missouri Association of Electric Co-ops, Let's come talk about the history of places like Livingston County. Before we go, I'd like to ask one question, my favorite part of the show. Charlie, if you had somebody coming up here, if you had Hawkins, if Garrett came up, where would you take him here in Livingston County? What would you show him?
Well, again, being a farmer from a farming background, you know, I would just want to take and show people the diversity of agriculture we have here in the county, you know, everything. You know, we've got some large row crop operations. We've got some large cattle operations. We've still got a lot of you know, smaller family-sized farms. And, you know, everything from that fertile bottom ground to upland to just our rolling grass pastures. There's a lot of different diversity of agriculture here in the county to be seen.
Jerry, if we brought Tanya Devendall up here, where would you take her?
Well, Tanya, I would hope she would come on one of the nights our chamber in Main Street hosted, like a wine walk or whatever they call it when it's the I don't know what it's called when you go around, taste all the beer. I don't know. Anyway, then we have a concert right across the street at the Silver Moon Plaza, and it's just a lot of fun. Hundreds and hundreds of people in the downtown area walking around, visiting our shops and restaurants, and that's where we'd hang out.
Judge, where would you take someone? Bring them here.
You know, it's a close call. I think I'm pretty similar to what Sherry said. I would probably like, especially if it's just a given day of the week, any given day of the week, I'd probably take them around, show them the square, show them the murals, because we have a lot of murals in the downtown Main Street program, and a lot of people have sponsored those, and it kind of tells the history of Chillicothe in a very nice way. We had a guy here that is now deceased, Kelly Poling, who was incredible at making these murals, and it's a neat thing that Chillicothe has, and it shows a lot of its history. And the park across the street, Silver Moon Plaza, he painted that over there too. It's just, it's a great way to kind of acquaint people with the past of Chillicothe and how beautiful it is now.
Ms. Jerry, I want to ask you a special question though. What's your favorite place at the State Fair? That's what I want to ask you first.
Oh gosh, probably the livestock barns.
Yeah. All right, now what's your favorite place here in Livingston County?
My answers have been taken, because I actually thought about that. I agree with Charlie, because I'm obviously have a passion for agriculture. I would want to show off the best of our county and what it has to offer as far as ag production. But I am extremely proud of our town in Chillicothe, and there's so much about it that would be a selling point to somebody who'd want to come and move here. We have great schools, we have great churches, but the unique thing is the murals, and I would want to show those off, because I think that that's not something you find in every town, and they're just very, very awesome. Our town, the Chamber of Commerce, does a great job of making our town beautiful, and it's something to show off, and I'm proud of it, and proud of the county. So.
Senator, besides the Jewel Paddock Museum, where would you take somebody here in Chillicothe or Livingston County and show them?
Well, I would imagine the other four can answer for me where I would take them.
The Litton Ag Center.
Yeah.
We've had visitors from the Litton Ag Center. Excuse me, Scott. Visitors to the Litton Ag Center from all over the world. So that of course is a place I know where to tour, and I know where to go dig up the lines and as well as show the nice stuff around there. So that's a place, and we do have a lot of visitors that I believe come to our community because of that center and the things that go on there as well.
Rusty's being a little modest. He had a big part in developing that out there. He did when he was at the VOTAC out here.
Jerry, thank you so much for the hospitality. I sure appreciate y'all having us here. We'll see you next time on the show, Missouri. History of Missouri, one county at a time.
Way down in Missouri, when I heard this lullaby, while the stars were blinking and the moon was shining high.